Welcome, everybody, back to the Pittsburgh Oddcast. My name is Andrew Lindberg, and with me, as always, is the founder of Odd Pittsburgh, John Chalkowski.
Hello, everybody, and a happy new year. Yes, a happy new year. A brand new year of shows. 2020. the Roaring Twenties.
Barbara Walters.
That's right. So, what do you think we should talk about in, you know, this very first episode of the very... of this year? Any ideas? Any questions? Any ideas?
Well, it's January.
January.
Cold,
yes. Cold. Well.
What do you got in store?
So, I was thinking about what, you know, what we could talk about, because we got lots and lots of shows in the lineup. But for this week, I kind of wanted to dig into some of my favorite stories of, like, Pittsburgh characters from the past. So, there's... many famous Pittsburghers, of course, like, you know, Andrew Carnegie and Frick and Andy Warhol and you name it, you know, left and right, you know, there's famous Pittsburghers. But there's also Pittsburghers who are not necessarily famous or maybe once were famous, but have since lost kind of that fame and lost their notoriety and have become kind of a figment of Pittsburgh's past. Including the first guy, which we'll talk about, which his story was was even unknown to people at his own time period, okay, which was the 1800s here. And you come across different people that sometimes in the paper have like a nice big obituary, you know, a nice big write-up, and you're like, wow, I didn't know this guy, who this guy was, or this guy even existed, or maybe I only knew him for one thing, and yet... he's famous for so much else that that nobody knew. I mean, these were things that you could finally reveal in an obituary. And that is basically what this first guy, named the Double X Cough Drop Man, is going to be about. And now, I wanted to dig into tales of three Pittsburghers, or people who eventually settled in Pittsburgh, you know, because you could say lots of things about lots of different people, but a lot of people weren't born in Pittsburgh. Like, I was thinking about maybe doing George Ferris, you know, the guy who invented the Ferris wheel. Not born in Pittsburgh.
Well, neither was Gustav Whitehead.
Neither was Gustav Whitehead, right? Neither was, you know, any of the most famous hockey players to play for the teams. You know, what you did here in Pittsburgh matters. I mean, it's a big difference. Carnegie, you know, prime example. Pittsburgh is what developed him as a man and what drove him for the rest of his life. And that's the same thing that goes with all of these three people. Pittsburgh was the underlying and kind of the thing that ties it all together. Even though these people lived in different centuries, that underlying theme of Pittsburgh's innovation and weirdness and inspiration. And I say weirdness because this guy I'm going to first talk about is the definition of what you would call odd.
Well, if his name is Double X Cough Drop Man, I think we're in for a treat.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, let's dive into the story, this first one of the Double X Cough Drop Man of Pittsburgh. So imagine yourself right in the corner of downtown Pittsburgh. This is the 19th century, okay? And you see a man standing on the corner, and he's very tall. He's got a stovepipe hat, a buffalo skin fur coat, a peg leg, and a bushy beard.
Is it a stovepipe hat or a stovetop hat?
You know, I wonder myself. I believe it is stovepipe.
Because I always thought it was Abraham Lincoln wore a stovetop hat.
That's right.
Or maybe I'm thinking of...
stovetop stuffing.
Stuffing.
Either or. I like it. So
he wore a big hat.
He wore a big, tall hat. There you go. Okay, he was a tall
like
man.
Like Abraham Lincoln.
Exactly, like Abraham Lincoln. Except this guy had a buffalo skin fur coat and a peg leg and a big old bushy beard. That's how most people in Pittsburgh remembered him. Now, when I say they remembered him, I mean, this guy was a legendary figure in downtown Pittsburgh. He was similar to Bob Lansbury that we talked about previously, where... you know, everybody knew that guy who had signs, you know, that walk around downtown Pittsburgh. But, you know, who was this guy? Like, you might see him, but who is he? Okay, and nobody knew.
Well, that's like late 90s, and there was the guy in Oakland, the sombrero guy.
Right.
He wore a sombrero and was asking for change.
Right.
And he had a little boombox next to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, like... You know, most people recognize these type of people, but nobody really knows who they are. And that was the case for this guy. His real name, Charles Orton, Okay. Better known as the Double X Cough Drop Man, sold cough drops, rain or shine, at the corner of Market Street and Diamond Street in downtown Pittsburgh. And he did this fact, selling these cough drops for over 40 years.
Is Diamond Street still there?
Or no, has it been Diamond Street turned into Market Street eventually. So it was like the core, but at that time period, there were two separate streets.
So now it'll be Market Street and Market Street.
Basically, yeah. Basically, the end of Market Square is where his shop kind of sat. Market Square has always been there. It used to be called Diamond, the Diamond, and they had different streets that were named around, like North Diamond, East Diamond, West Diamond, eventually called North Market, South Market, East Market, so on and so forth. But somewhere around that corner near Market Square, this guy for 40 years sold these weird cough drops, from a wooden box. And that was basically it. He was just seen as a strange and unusual guy, peg leg and all, who would, happily sell these things. Well, not until he died did people finally find out the real story behind this man. Orton, Charles Orton, born in Allegheny City in 1846, okay? Prior to his cough drop career, he dabbled in several different diverse areas of study, including tightrope walking, acting, was one of the original riders for the Pony Express. At 14 years old, he enlisted to fight in the Civil War, when he was 14. Was, of course, too young, and he was turned away, but he later rejoined the Army as a drummer boy until his parents found him and eventually forced him to move back home, only for him to run away and join the circus. Okay. During this time of the circus, he performed as a comedian. He was an actor, and that's where he practiced his tightrope walking. This also led to him driving wagons across the plains. He became a railway brakeman, which is how he lost his leg.
Well, what's railway brakeman?
Which I've done a lot of genealogy. I'm fascinated by family trees. And a lot of family trees, you'll see people that work for the railroad, and they all had different types of jobs. And one of the most common jobs you'll see on there is a thing called brakeman, which at first I had no idea what that is either. Like, what's a brakeman? What's that do? Well, back prior to the Westinghouse air brakes, each single car of a train had to be stopped manually by hand. And these people, they called brakemen, would ride the cars, either on top of the car or, next to it. And when time would come, would have to apply the brakes to that car. Or jump from car to car to apply the brakes. One of the most dangerous positions that was known in the railroad industry. And in fact, if you fell off and just fell into a ditch somewhere, they'd just leave you there.
So they couldn't stop. I mean,
they couldn't stop.
It takes a mile.
Yeah.
Right now, still for trains today to stop. So yeah. if there's a car stalled at an intersection, and you see the train, it's too late because they can't stop. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why Westinghouse invented his air brake, is because of that. The tragedies were so immense during that time period leading up to the invention of the air brake, which basically solved that problem.
Well, you also mentioned he was part of the Pony Express.
Yeah.
Which is such an interesting part of U.S. history because it only lasted about 2 years, if that.
Yeah.
And it was... somebody would be on a horse or a pony for 10 miles,
mm-hmm.
and they'd go to a stop, and then they would drop off to the next rider.
Right.
And 10 miles. So it was 10 miles, 10 miles, 10 miles, all the way to the West Coast.
Yeah.
That's insane. 10 miles.
It is insane.
I mean,
insane.
You do 10 miles in, a couple minutes now on the parkway or in the turnpike. Well, not the parkway.
Oh, yeah.
Traffic.
It's like on foot, fast, as fast as you possibly could, because messenger service, it was revolutionary.
Well, it was because
odd to think about it today.
You would get a letter in under a month instead of years.
Yeah, years for letters. Yeah, of course. But still, yes. Back in those time periods, it was not easy to get mail. I mean, if you were going to address mail to Pittsburgh, like say you lived anywhere, within the metropolitan area of Pittsburgh, the letters were addressed to John Shulkowski, Pittsburgh, PA, and that's it. So you just had to get that letter somehow to Pittsburgh and then, shuffle it off into where it needed to go. And it was a complicated process, no doubt about that. And we're lucky. We're very lucky to live. I'm sure people 100 years from now will say, I can't believe these old people. I mean, they actually emailed people, So
we live by the zip code, which, the zone improvement plan, which is each number represents something.
Yeah.
and you know,
and even that's not that old. I mean, that came around the 1960s. The zip codes, 15, by the way, meaning your state code,
mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania. You know, interesting stuff. But anyways, back from the Pony Express, which is fascinating. I mean, I'm sure who knows. I mean, no one really knows this full story. I mean, these are like the little things that were gathered, but in his obituary, after he joined the circus and became a comedian, an actor, a tightrope walker. And of course did his whole, Brakeman and doing the Pony Express. He also, went shooting and performed with the Buffalo Bill Wild West show. And, also was in the original acted in the original production of Uncle Tom's Cabin. So, and this guy for 40 years selling cough drops in the middle of downtown Pittsburgh. He was such a natural, just everything he tried. One day he just wanted, there's a direct quote I found in the newspaper. One day he decided I wanted to do this, and he would just go off and do it, no matter how strange or outrageous a skill it was. This type of person he was. With a desire to settle down, he eventually got married and moved back to Pittsburgh. And while coming back on a trip to Philadelphia, he saw how the cough drop industry was booming there and decided to bring that industry to Pittsburgh, where he opened up a little small shop and eventually sold to the streets. Selling cough drops.
So he wasn't homeless.
No, he looked like it. He had that weird big beaver coat or whatever, buffalo skin coat, and he had that peg leg, you know, which gives him a little bit of character.
Well, I mean, compared to today, if you saw, and we'll post this photo on kdkradio.com, but if you look at him today, you would say, he's not homeless. He doesn't need any help. But at the time,
yeah,
that was the common, you know.
Well, yeah, you think that someone's selling, you know, cough drops for $2 a you know, a bushel or something. It's like, you know, what else might be going on in their life that they're now doing this for 40 years? Apparently a lot was going on in this guy's life. His nickname, Double X, by the way, he got because he ran for political office and failed, and people felt he was double-crossed. So they called him the double-crossed or Double X. Man, that's the origin of the name. It's not because it's like, you know, liquor or something else inside the cough drops.
I was going to say, that sounds like,
like a dirty cough drop.
It sounds like an awesome hip hop name today.
Yeah, Double X. Yeah, exactly. Double X. Well, you'll see from the photo, just all cool that actually does look, you know, when he posted on his little cough drop thing, you know. But this is just one example of like one of the stories that just kind of, you know, lost the time. The stories that you would not find about unless someone actually took a photo of the guy and cared enough to figure out who he was.
Well, it also, you know, raises the question of when you see. I know that Double X wasn't a homeless person, but when you see a homeless person, you just dismiss them as somebody that doesn't have a job and they don't have
it together. Yeah, you don't see them for...
But you don't know what they've been through.
Right, right,
I mean,
exactly.
This gentleman here, Pony Express, circus,
yeah.
I mean, that's insane. Like, those are all stories.
Drummer Boy in the Civil War, you know.
And
I mean, it goes on and on and on, this guy's life story, and it's like... It's even this time with Buffalo Bill traveling around that Wild West show. I mean, think about how cool that would have been, or acting in the very first production of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
I mean, he kind of looks in the picture. You'll see he kind of looks like Sir Ian McKellen a little bit.
He does. Yeah.
A very distinguished man with a peg leg and a giant beaver coat selling cough drops.
Exactly.
Which what would, you know, maybe today he'd be selling, I don't know. Cell phones?
yeah, basically, the cell phone man of Pittsburgh. Well, hey, you know, you never know. Maybe one of these people have a story to tell that has yet to be untold. So go ahead and make sure you look at these hidden figures, because, I mean, this guy, I found out about him from a photograph. I mean, that was it. I was just like, well, what is a Double X? You know, who is this man, this weird, interesting-looking guy? He looks like he could be like the grandfather of like Mr. Odd, right? Or maybe that is Mr. Odd. I don't know, you know?
Well, you told us when we started this journey that you were going to unveil the ways that you find these figures.
Yeah.
And I think, is that one of the ways, like if an obituary is a little bit extended?
Yeah.
Or you see a photo of something like that, is that what catches your attention?
Well, I'll give you a prime example when we get to our third story, and I'll tell you exactly how I found that story, because that's the most fresh in my memory. Of how I came across that, you know, what inspired me to look him up in the first place. Because a lot of these people, you know, they're on Wikipedia, maybe not Wikipedia, you know, just Google search, you're not going to find too much about them. Even old newspapers, you're not going to find too much about them. So it's like it takes someone as a catalyst to kind of put it somewhere for people like me 100 years later to stumble across it and dig into it more. Now that technology's caught up, yeah, we have the availability to go, kind of go in there, dig up things that have not been able to be found before, and look at it from new light. So our second tale involves a legendary figure who a lot of people might only know because one of the halls at the University of Pittsburgh is named after him. And that is Holland Hall. But have you ever heard, other than the fact that we mentioned it once before in our very first episode of the Pittsburgh Podcast, the prehistoric episode, the name William Jacob Holland? Right, yeah. So he's somebody who I've never really knew of, other than the fact that he apparently in 1921 discovered gigantic 9-foot-tall people living in Verona.
It's from the first episode.
From the first episode. So if you haven't heard about some of his finds, archaeological finds here in Pittsburgh, along with many other tales, check out that very, very first episode of the Pittsburgh Podcast, the prehistoric Pittsburgh. But William Jacob Holland was the curator of the Carnegie Museum, and he was also the chancellor at University of Pittsburgh. So these are not spoiler alerts, because these are kind of commonly known things, at least to the academic world, that this guy named William Holland was indeed the very first, I guess you could say, official. Technically, there was another director of the Carnegie Museum, a very first one. Mm-hmm. But you ready for what happened to him? He was part of the archaeological dig in McKees Rocks during the Indian burial mound in 1896. And while trying, that was his very first like gig as the curator of the brand new museum, you know, that Carnegie was putting together. And he decided to kind of camp out there on McKees Rocks in the burial mound. And while there, not only digging up 30-something people who were buried on top of the mound, but was considered cursed. And so much so that lightning struck. There was a rainstorm one day, and everyone's in their tents. Lightning struck, and it killed one of the men instantly inside the tent that he was standing in. And he considered this, like, obviously a bad omen, you know, and quit the next day. So that was the very first director of the Carnegie Museum.
Do we know his name?
Frank Gerardet was his name. So, you know, what do you do afterwards? You know, who do you get next? You know, who's going to follow up?
Where
this?
Do you go from here?
Right. You know, when the first director is almost killed by an act of God, right?
Hey, the last guy got scared away by a curse. How would you like?
Yeah. Well, enter the picture, this man, William Jacob Holland. He was born as son of a preacher, born in Jamaica in 1848.
Son of a preacher man.
Son of a preacher man from Jamaica, man.
Jamaica.
Yes. 1848, okay? He attended the Moravian Boys' School, where he went to later to Amherst College, the class of 1869, and then later Princeton Theological Seminary. But while at Amherst, one of the colleges he was at, his roommate was a student from Japan. And he just kind of became real fascinated with Japanese culture and the language and just, you know, getting to know a little bit about Japan. This is the 1870s, okay? And decided to learn Japanese for himself and became fluent in Japanese in the 1870s. Okay, so
even today, I'm impressed if anybody exactly. becomes fluent in Japanese or any language.
Yeah, especially this man from Jamaica. In 1874, he moves back to Pittsburgh, and through kind of a long, he had a religious background. So, you know, and he went to that theological school, Princeton's Theological School of all schools, and you kind of move, you know, where there's an opening. So in 1874, there was an opening in Oakland at the Belfield Presbyterian Church, and he became the head pastor. And that was his job. That's what he wanted to do. You know, he was kind of brought up to do this. His parents did this kind of the similar type of thing, and now he wanted to take his hand at becoming a pastor of a church. But in his spare time, you ready for this? He taught ancient languages at Chatham University, which at that time, and joined up with the naturalist expedition called the U.S. Eclipse Expedition in 1887 to explore Japan. Since he was already fluent, you know, it was pretty easy for him to go do. Now, this Eclipse Expedition was basically an expedition to go on a boat in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, towards Japan and view the eclipse from a boat. This is apparently a big famous one in 1887. They needed representatives from all different states, all different types of fields, you know. And he went on this trip. Brashear actually helped put him on that boat.
John Brashear.
John Brashear,
another
yeah.
former...
Good old Uncle John.
Episode.
That's right. That's right. So he had a little bit of kind of working his ways within Pittsburgh higher-ups, like people like John Brashear, and ran into Andrew Carnegie multiple times. And people knew of him because this guy was so kind of out there with his interests, you know, teaching ancient languages and, you know, on the side, you know, all this Japanese type of thing. Where
so he not only knew Japanese, but he knew ancient languages that were kind of like out of date.
Yeah, like Sanskrit and all that type of thing, you know. But his main interest in life, and this really throughout his entire life until the day he died, was a thing. And I looked up the pronunciation of it. So lepidepterology. 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 And that is... the study of butterflies and moths. So this is what really fascinated him.
You know, somebody that studies that is going to correct us.
Enough. Butterfly studying. That's what he was an expert at.
We're going to have a butterfly studier tell us we're saying it wrong.
Oh, I'm sure
and
we
hopefully
will. Hopefully, I'm sure we will.
You can correct us.
But he, you know, also kind of became fascinated in paleontology. And
can you tell us what paleontology is real quick?
Well, it's the study of the ancient past, you know, through archaeology, specifically dinosaurs. And there was one big dinosaur that he was kind of responsible for. And but let's before we jump to that, 1901, I don't know how, and it's unclear, really, through the history books. I tried to look it up, how Andrew Carnegie found him and picked him as to become the new director, but he did. I guess this guy just had a way with words or something. I mean, this pastor who was an ancient language teacher who studied butterflies on the side is now the brand new director of the Carnegie Museum.
He sounds qualified enough for me.
Yeah. He would remain that until 1922, his retirement. So for 21 years, he was the director of the museum. But he was the guy who supervised the dig and also was able to bring the Diplodocus or Diplodocus, depending on which side of the aisle you stand on, was able to bring that to Pittsburgh, which is the technical, scientific name of the one that's here in Carnegie. I mean, in the Carnegie Museum, is called the Diplodocus Carnegie, like with an II at the very
Dippy.
End. Dippy. Dippy. That's right. That is Dippy the dinosaur right there. But that's the same one. That's the original, the first, most complete Diplodocus, Diplodocus, whatever. And I say this whatever because if you look at the origin of the word, it comes from two words, two separate words. Diplos, meaning double, and docus, meaning beam. Double beam. That's what Diplodocus, as two words, would be.
But we should just Google it and see what they say.
Google will tell you. Diplodocus, even though if you translate from the Greek, those two words, it is Diplodocus.
Well, we also say North Versailles when it should be North Versailles.
Yeah,
so.
I'm gonna call that a Pittsburgher thing. I don't know. Pittsburghese? Is Diplodocus a Pittsburghese thing?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Hey, we went down to Premier's and we got some of that Diplodocus.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think that would be it, right? But he, while studying you know, like all the ancient languages, he also ended up getting a job at the University of Pittsburgh where he started, for some reason, without any kind of background, teaching anatomy and zoology. Until finally, he was so well-diversed in his skills that he became the 8th chancellor at the University of Pittsburgh in 1891.
Well, he sounds like kind of a prodigy.
Yeah, yeah.
He learned Japanese,
yeah,
ancient languages, all these other things.
Zoology, anatomy, you know, all the eclipse expedition, you know, all these different little things. By the time he died, which was in, he was 84 years old, he passed away. He was living at 5545. Forbes Avenue. The place is no longer there, but it's basically across the street from Carnegie Mellon University today, and he's buried in Allegheny Cemetery, and he donated all of his specimens, personal collection, not, you know, the museum's collection, his own personal collection of over 250,000 butterflies and moths to the museum, which are still there on display to this day.
Yeah, you can see them.
That's right. those were his. And I don't know where he kept them, but those were his, and he was the guy who did find that and put that all together. And it's just an interesting figure. So, I mean, that's kind of like what this episode's, you know, themed is about. It's about these interesting figures, these people who were like, you know, you might know them as like the name of, you know, the Chancellor of University of Pittsburgh because of Holland Hall. You kind of might have known his name as just the director of the Carnegie Museum, but...
But you don't know why.
I didn't know this guy was from Jamaica, kind of pastor, all these other things, you know?
145 years before Cool Runnings became a movie, this guy was the director.
Yeah.
Born in Jamaica, director of the Carnegie Museum.
That's right. That's right. Very interesting stuff. I mean, you'll see a picture. I have a couple photos of him, which are pretty cool. And
yeah, we'll post those too.
He, of course, you know, was involved in that 1921 Giants of Allegheny story. So go back and listen to that. But I try to save the best for last. In fact, I kind of want to do a little series of shows like this where I talk about like three or four different Pittsburghers who you might not know. People like George, you know, Ferris. You know, his story, while tragic, he died in his 30s, you know, the guy who did that. But there's lots of stories to share, and this one really fascinated me. It still does. There's still more to the story, which is not...
Well, I hope so. We're talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. I found it fascinating enough to at least do the research, do the digging, and this is the one I'm going to tell you about, how I was inspired to talk about it, or just, even just learn about who it is. Like you said before, like we've talked about in other shows, I'll spend a lot of free time just searching Google, you know, basically for interesting Pittsburgh-related things. Now, that path could lead me to places that normally would not lead you if you're going to study Pittsburgh history. Most people, if you think about Pittsburgh history, you're going to start with, you know, right here in Pittsburgh. You're going to look at the Carnegie Museum. You're going to look at the Heinz History Center. You're going to look at these local, you know, places first. Then maybe newspaper research. Then maybe genealogy research, because that's part of history. And those records and documents tell you a lot about a person. But this came about when I was searching in the San Diego Public Library. So one of the tricks to finding the good stuff, okay, is to not look in Pittsburgh. That's a good thing and a bad thing, I guess, you know. But the it's not a bad thing, because what's happened is people throughout time, you know, would move to California, let's say, you know, the descendants of, or someone related to this next person we're talking about, moved to California, I guess, passed away in the 1950s, and then just left a bunch of piles of photos and documents and things in their house and whatever, and eventually somebody just donated it to the public library, and they took the effort to scan it and post it online. And that is where I first heard and first saw a picture of a woman named Helen Ritchie. So now, does the name ring any bells?
No.
Right. So, and that is a complete shame, because this woman is legendary.
I mean, sorry.
Well, it's not your fault. That's the thing. Nobody. There's one book, one single book that was written in the 1960s, long after she passed away, that tried to kind of piece together little bits and pieces of her life based on interviews with her family that were still surviving and friends and people that knew her. But there's no real biography, nothing ever really put together other than the fact of the different things and accomplishments that she kind of did. Not until you really start digging into the newspapers and trying to see kind of what's left or find out what's still out there, do you discover this amazing story of this woman, a first in Pittsburgh. Now, the first photo, by the way, I saw of her is her as a very young girl, 19 years old. Just learning, you know, she's dressing up in her first pilot's album, you know, in her first pilot's license kind of outfit. And
yeah, she has the leather helmet. And then the goggles.
Goggles, you know, the leather jackets, you know. And then as I start going through other photos, I find photos of her when she was a little bit younger, like 15 to 20. And you could just tell by the photograph that this wasn't some kind of ordinary girl. She wasn't just some kind of, there was something in her eyes. And I'm being honest. That's how I discovered this person. I looked at her photo, and I'm like, there's something behind these eyes that I must know.
Well, let's learn about her.
Right. Helen Ritchie was born to fly. Okay, number one. 19, 20 years old is when she first learned how to fly the airplane. Born in McKeesport, okay, in 1909. She was the youngest of five kids to the superintendent of McKeesport's public schools. In 1928, the McKeesport native was a passenger on a daily flight from McKeesport to Cleveland. And that took, kind of gave her the inspiration of just being on a plane. I mean, think about this, 1928, you know, prior to that, the only way you're going to get on an airplane is if you're the Red Baron in World War One. You know, you're not going to likely have lots of commercial airline experience. Commercial airlining was just kind of in its infancy of actually bringing passengers on an airplane and transporting them to different places. But she,
this wasn't soon after Charles Lindbergh's flight.
That's correct.
This isn't you're waiting in line at TSA at the airport. This is you're getting on an airplane and let's hope you make it.
Exactly. You know, so of course that was the exact impression that her father had. And although her father, being the man he was, it was very generous, you know, to her and let his youngest daughter, kind of get away with anything she really wanted to do. And he signed her up for flying lessons. Now, she wasn't the first female pilot. I mean, as soon as people were flying airplanes, women were doing it too. You just don't hear about them that often. Not unless they accomplish some kind of feat or some kind of big historic thing or something.
Amelia Earhart.
Right. Or disappeared. You know?
But she was famous before that.
Right. But would you know the same amount of information about her if she didn't disappear? And that's that's the question. Like, same thing with this Helen Ritchie. Like, her accomplishments just as fantastic and even more groundbreaking than some of Amelia Earhart's same things. They, in fact, competed together on teams. I'm getting ahead of the story. Anyways, she saw a very famous female pilot named Ruth Elder, okay, on this trip.
I've never heard of.
Right, yeah. There's a lot of them. In fact, my grandmother told me that when she was a little girl, there was one of these famous female pilots, I guess, came to their apartment, used to hang out with her mother, and she'd always remembered her being there in the late 1920s, early 1930s, and how cool it was that she was like a female pilot, you know, and just how neat that must be, because it was definitely a man's world. In fact, it still is. Can you name, have you ever been on a plane that has a female pilot?
Not that I know of.
Right.
I haven't been on many planes, but...
I've been on plenty of planes, and I've not seen too many head pilots. I'm sure they exist, you know. I'm just saying you don't... It's not a common...
That's a shame.
Thing. It is. You know, we just got over saying female stewardess, you know, with just female, you know, with just personnel, you know, on an airplane. So we're still kind of... You know, getting into that, you know,
even though in the 1920s,
even though 2020,
we had,
yeah,
even though in the 1920s, 100 years ago,
that's right,
we had female pilots that could kick butt.
Well, and Helen Ritchie was the star of that show. On October 27th, 1929, she started taking flying lessons. Within months, okay, by June, she had her pilot's license. Within a few months after that, she traveled to Johnsonburg. To participate in the dedication of an airport, right, and to watch a kind of nice aerial exhibit. While there, okay, because she just had her pilot's license, even though she had less than 30 hours of flying, you know, time actually in the air, flying the airplane, okay, convinced or somehow talked her way with her charm into letting her, letting the people test an airplane, and she was just going to take it up and kind of circle around the field and come back and land it, and that was going to be that, you know, and whatever it is, that's what it is. So instead, she gets up in the airplane, okay? She circles the field a few times, and then instead of landing, she decides to test the limits of the plane by doing a complete upside-down loop.
A loop-de-loop.
A loop-de-loop, that's right. Then she decided to rise up to almost 3,000 feet, okay, at elevation, cut the engine, and go into a tailspin barrel roll straight toward the ground. It gets close to 2,000 feet, right, to the ground. Then she gets to 1,000 feet, which is not that high up for airplanes. Then she decided she knew how to, you know, swing the full rudder into the opposite direction, kind of, and put the motor in full throttle, pulled up, and was able to straighten out the airplane right at the last second. Of course, this made people just scream. You know, they didn't know what was going on. Like, this tiny little girl. She was tiny. She was 4'10". 4'11", maybe at the most, you know, on a good day, under 5 feet tall, 19-year-old girl from McKeesport, PA, right, doing these crazy barrel rolls and loop-de-loops all over the place, and she hasn't even been in the air for less than a day. Okay? That's how she started out. So when you start from way up there, where do you go from there? Yeah.
Yeah, well, after that, what do you have?
She really had this dream to become a commercial pilot, like one that would, you know, fly people around. Also, even just like a FedEx pilot, you know, one that would fly stuff, you know, from here to there. And on December 4th, 1930, she became the very first woman in American history to achieve this record of the very first commercial pilot as a female.
And how common was this for even anybody to have
not
this
common.
Kind of status?
Not common. In fact, she basically did this just because of the way she looked and the way she acted and her kind of spunk and personality, which is what I noticed from her photos. I mean, that's what draw me to her was her photograph. Without knowing anything about her, I just saw the photo of her, and I'm like, well, I didn't even know who this person is because they're obviously a fascinating person. Sure enough, you know, she is. So she not only does this, gets her first, you know, the very first commercial pilot license in history as a woman, but then she's wanted to set out records, okay, for speed and endurance after becoming the very first woman in Allegheny County to even earn a pilot's license. Okay? So that's where she technically fits into the history of Pittsburgh, is that she is, Helen Ritchie, the very first woman to ever have a pilot's license in Allegheny County. But one of her when you talk about like records and endurance type of things, you know, you're talking about, you know, most flights go up, you know, if you're going to go from here, Pittsburgh to Los Angeles, it's going to take you 4.5-5 hours.
Yeah.
You know, on a good day.
And you're going up like, what, 35,000 some feet.
Right. Imagine staying in the air for a week. That was her goal. Without landing. Okay.
How's that possible?
By refueling the plane while in the air.
Herself?
Yes. And now ready for this? In 1933, she joined another famous female pilot named Frances Harrell Marsalis and set the actual woman's flight endurance record, remaining aloft for 9 days, 21 hours, and 50 minutes.
I don't think those planes had bathrooms back then.
They didn't. So it took off on December 20th and landed on December 30th.
Oh, my goodness.
On the third day of the journey, a refueling hose ripped out of a hole in the rear of the plane's fabric, and she had to climb out into the wing mid-flight with a needle and thread and sew it up herself. Now, there's a photograph of this happening, actually, if you Google Helen Ritchie.
Well, how do they have the photograph?
Because it was like an event, you know, like they'd let the press know beforehand.
So they had, okay.
And be like, so hey, we're going to be the longest. Them. Yeah. And now I'm sure that not all, you know, 24/7 all day long following them, but at certain times they did. And that particular photograph does exist. So basically a hero in the female commercial world, you know, of the piloting world, but not a hero in aviation. Because aviation at that time was very, very controlled and very, very sexist.
Oh, that sounds a lot like now.
Exactly. So, you know, with all this happening, okay, she would go to national air meets, you know, for women. She would give more demonstrations, you know, daredevil stunts. It's not every day that this, you know, a girl wants to become a stunt pilot, like, from day one. Okay?
No, yeah.
You know,
not...
rips into a barrel roll, you know, before you even knew how to fly a plane, really. But in 1934, she successfully became, there was a Greensburg-based company, okay, called Central Airlines, and she convinced them somehow to give them a commercial pilot license, and she became the first woman in the world to ever do this.
And just be like, we're approaching the final destination, I'm going to do a couple barrel rolls, and then we're going to cut the engines, and let's see what happens, folks.
Yeah, in fact, there's a story about... She, one of the kind of charming stories is that she had a nephew who was about, you know, 10 years old or so. And she never liked to actually fly with people when she was doing these things, you know, these barrel runs and all that type of stuff, except with her dog, who she would keep as her co-pilot.
Yeah, because, I mean, if he goes, then, you know, what do you
I guess, do? You know, and a little, you know, some companionship, you know, there while you're in the skies. And, But she would do things like her her niece actually was going to college, and she told her niece, I was like, well, I'll just fly you down, you know. But then she'd have weird nicknames for people. She, in fact, called her niece Nancy McSlap Cabbage. It's a direct quote.
That sounds kind of racist. I don't know.
McSlap Cabbage?
You got a Nancy McSlap Cabbage over here.
Some weird things. She called her her nephew Poopy Face. So, but her nephew, who was quoted in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
Who had poop all over his face.
Right. In the 1960s, was quoted saying that he remembered as a kid going off and hanging out with his aunt, who wasn't much older than her himself. He was only 10 years younger than her, and decided to go off these kind of like week, day-long excursions where they'd fly out of Allegheny County and just show up in Butler or somewhere and land some airfield and have a picnic and then fly back home. And he said that one time during this flight, she did the same. It's like, hey, you want to try flying the plane?
What?
He's like, well, I'm only 10. You know, I don't know how to fly the plane. And she let go of the controls and goes, here you go. And just walked, apparently stood up and walked to the back of the plane. Right? That's kind of like a joke, knowing that it was going to go out of control and then she was going to correct it somehow. She was a dare. I mean, it's just crazy daredevil, you know.
Well, how confident do you have to be a daredevil and
super
have your
confident.
Nephew?
Yes, super confident. She imbued confidence. I mean, just the photographs of her, each one, you could tell she's a confident woman. Not alone in these kind of like woman's first things and you know, world first weren't her goal. She wasn't trying to set out to become these things. That's just.
No, it just sounds like who she was.
Right, it's who she was.
It didn't matter. I mean, sex wasn't a thing. It was just, this was her.
Well, you know, pretty soon after she became the actual first woman commercial pilot for Central Airlines, she did fly to Washington, D.C. And to Detroit, a direct route, which means she had to cross the Allegheny Mountains, being the first woman to ever do so. But there's a union involved, you know, when it comes to airline pilots. And the all-male pilots union was super angry at the fact that she got this license in 1934. Because of the controversy, the airline started sending her on less and less trips. And by the time of 8 months, she was refused membership in the union and resigned from her airline job by 1935. Okay, even though she became the first woman in the world to rate as an airline instructor, okay, the following year, first person to teach other people how to fly a plane, as a female, officially, where she ended up training people for the U.S. Air Force. Okay.
And when you say people, you probably mean men.
Men. So. That's right. Yeah. Now, you know, when you're in that kind of small group of people, female aviators, and by the way, she never, and they would call her an aviatrix in the papers, and she made a big point to never, ever go by an aviatrix or whatever. She just wanted to be pilot, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't want to be anything other than, you know, what she was, not some kind of unique female thing or terminology. She didn't like that terminology of calling her an aviatrix. So you'd meet other people that were involved in the same type of field that you were in, of course. And what other famous female pilot can you even think of? There's only one, really. You know,
yeah, it's
Amelia
Lindbergh.
Earhart.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Him too.
Well,
her
yeah.
too.
Amelia Earhart, right? And sure enough, they competed in races, which means that you would go up in a plane and try to compete as fast as you possibly can to complete like a course, return, and successfully land. And she would actually co-pilot her Lockheed aircraft for a cross-country race with Amelia Earhart in 1939. And they finished in fifth place.
Fifth place.
But this was against, this was open to anybody that
Everybody.
Wanted to do it. Yeah, exactly. So you're competing against some of the big bigwigs, you know, who've been doing this for years. You know, where this is within a decade, the very first female pilots ever. You know, so you're talking about a different type of, you know, situation. Which
yeah, this is less than a decade after she started
literally
flying.
Yeah, you know, only to come and, you know, to team up with Amelia Earhart herself. And now, there was many different communications back and forth between the two. They had a really great friendship, a friendship that some say that they might have been lovers. Mm-hmm. Is no way, you know, another way of putting it. She, both of them, you know, had were kind of interested in men, but it was also clear from the photographs and from some of the writing that they did have some kind of mutual attraction to each other. So it was a it was interesting to see kind of how that worked out and what happened to, you know, what was Helen's response when Amelia Earhart disappeared.
Yeah.
Did she disappear? What happened? You know, no one knows. Everyone's still debating it to this day. But, you know, life goes on, right? So what do you do after you're not allowed to join the union of the being a commercial pilot? The only goal she really ever wanted to do. She did do airmail and would fly airmail back and forth, you know, that as her passenger, well, I guess you could say.
The equivalent of the Pony Express, only in an airplane.
That's right. That's
it all comes full circle.
And believe it or not, I was able to track down, and it was hard. And I've been looking for a long time. I should have brought it so you could see it. But I have an autographed piece of mail from Helen Ritchie that she flew
post it.
Over. Yeah, that she flew over, you know, the course of doing one of these airmail trips. And it's from 1930, the very first year that she learned how to fly. It's fantastic. So there's no letter inside it, unfortunately. But, you know, it's still cool just to see that it was, you know, touched her fingertips. And now it's at my house. So, but the story does not have a happy ending. Okay? Mm-hmm. And it's sad to say. But to help American allies during World War II, she served with Britain's Air Transport Auxiliary, which was a service that helped ferries, Spitfires, Hurricanes, and bombers all over Great Britain, from factories to Royal Air Force bases to aerodromes.
Are those types of airplanes?
They are. Big ones. I'm talking like the war machines of the day. She achieved the rank of a major in the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, where she ferried planes and towed anti-aircraft targets for the U.S. Air Force.
And for Britain?
Well, Britain and for America. Her later job in World War II was to actually what they call paint fields, where they would go. You remember? So this is a time period where there was electricity in an airfield was non-existent, really. So you had some reflected type of things, mm-hmm. or just really bright white paint or yellow paint painted on barns and locations along the way. And you would have to try to, like, look down at, you know, out the side of your cockpit. And be like, oh, okay, we're heading towards
Barnstormer.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what she ended up doing eventually in life, right? But after World War II, work was pretty hard to come by. A 38-year-old was found dead in her apartment from a parent's suicide in 1947.
Do we know where this apartment was?
I do, because that's the part of the story that gets a little strange. There's not, like I said before, there's not much that's written on who she even was. You know, even her Wikipedia page is very sparse. In fact, I should add a lot of stuff to the Wikipedia page just so she has a more full biography. But I spent the time to you know, track down through newspaper research, archives throughout the entire United States, not just Pittsburgh, also find her death certificate. I wrote and got her coroner's report. And because over telling you all these accomplishments and all these cool things and her personality and, you know, just all these kind of things, it doesn't fit, you know, that she would kill herself. You know, now you would say, you know, that didn't fit Robin Williams either. And you don't really know what's going on.
Yeah, you never know what's happening inside.
You never know. However, there is indiscrepancies on her death. And let me explain. January 7th, the newspaper's first report, okay, that she's found dead with an empty water tumbler beside her. She told her friends that she was contemplating suicide, and one of the detectives said that she's been despondent for a long time, okay? That's all that article really said, that she was under the care of several doctors. Okay, the following day, in New York, the New York Daily News, it says that she was found mysteriously dead at 7:30 p.m. that night. Autopsy will be performed in a one-room furnished apartment she was wearing at 400 West 22nd Street. She was wearing a pink nightgown under the covers of a daybed near the window. Her face was discolored, and she might have been dead for a couple days. Okay, they said she was last spoken to a previous Sunday afternoon. The following article I find says that also confirms that she was perhaps dead for several days. Also noted her endurance record of 237 hours up in the air, which is crazy. But the same day in Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph, right, says an autopsy revealed that there was no cause of death that could be determined. The medical examiner said that death had been induced by a general congestion of the organs. and that the chemical analysis would have to be done to further find out. But it says that this time she was in a red and white dotted polka dot pajamas, not a pink nightgown like the previous article said. It also said that her neighbor said that we knew that she's been a little bit under the weather, but we didn't know it was that bad. She apparently did visit her father that December of that same year, had a kind of funny feeling that she wasn't going to see him again. And she did tell him that, apparently, when she, you know, was leaving Pittsburgh, McKeesport, where her family still lived. I mean, she never had any kids, but she has four older siblings who have all had kids, and some of them are still kind of around. The following day after that, a preliminary report from the medical examiner claimed that she died of natural causes and not the suicide, which is linked to her through most newspaper articles or reports.
So where did she die?
In New York City. This time says that she was in a full pink nightgown again. Another person said that we know that she's been doctoring, but we didn't know how much or that she's been sick. There's another quote that was mentioned in the newspaper. Also says that there's a quote that someone overheard her say years earlier that when a girl reaches 37, her flying days are done. She also told people that she was flying very little nowadays. Now it's the funeral details. Okay, we're coming back, and they had a little bit more of a investigation into the autopsy. Now they changed their cause of death to general visceral congestion. The following visceral congestion. 2 days after that, okay, her body was brought back here to McKeesport. Four airplanes flew overhead the funeral home. They said two poems at her funeral, at her eulogy. One called "A Pilot's Halo" by Don Blanding. Another one called "High Flight" by John McGee. And she was buried in Versailles Cemetery under a tiny little marker, no bigger than this piece of paper I'm holding in my hand. If you go to her grave, it says her name, Helen Ritchie, and then it says 1909, 1947, and that's it. Nothing. With no kind of, you know, hurrah or memorial to her, although there was a park named in McKeesport named after her, named Helen Ritchie Park, Memorial Park, which a lot of people had no idea who that park was named after because it's been named that for 70 years. The final thing I found was that on January 24th, so it was about 2 weeks after her death, that the chemical analysis of her autopsy finally came back and says that it was primarily due to barbituric acid poisoning. And they found that the amount in her brain was 5.2 milligrams to 100 grams of brain tissue, which was very excessive for a person accustomed even to barbituric sedatives. An additional 46 milligrams of the barbituric acid was found in half her stomach, and the brain tissue showed 4+ alcohol. But he did not know whether death was accidental or on purpose, because someone with that high level of a sleep sedative, basically, sleeping powder, that was apparently she drank or somehow or ingested somehow, even for somebody who was trying to or used to doing this, this was such a high abnormal amount that it was suspicious. And that's it. That's where the story kind of ended with her, was the fact that nobody knows how she died, other than the fact that they saw her there, you know? The last thing I'll leave you with her is, during the war, a good friend of hers was quoted in the newspaper I found, which is kind of a cool quote. And she said that Helen was a person who just loved people, especially screwballs. And she had her best time wandering around London, falling in and out of strangers and winding up in odd eating places with various brands of foreigners who would tell her wild and mysterious tales. My kind of chick, you know, this Helen Ritchie.
And I don't think we say chick anymore.
You know, well, hey.
Your kind of lady.
My kind of lady, your woman, you know, someone I'd like to get to know.
That's my kind of dame.
That's right. You know, fascinated by a photograph. That's how that story turned out. Into this epic kind of story of a woman who was unlike anybody who I've ever heard of in aviation history, and just that kind of fighting spirit, only to be cut short so quick by mysterious death.
I wonder if the indiscrepancies about her, what she was wearing and everything, are attributed to maybe just lack of information at the time. The way that if something happens today and it's instantaneous, we hear, you know, five people are hurt. Oh, wait, it's seven. Oh, wait, it's two. Oh, wait, everything's okay.
Right. You'd think that. However, now the AP stories would all be the same, you know, so because they're all come from the AP, which some of those were stories were. Other ones were like kind of like follow-ups and things. But then some of the follow-ups went back to, say, a pink nightgown. The other ones were, say, red and white.
Mm.
You know, Other ones were saying that she was on the daybed. Other ones saying that she wasn't on the daybed. One saying that she 100% was a depressed woman and killed herself no matter what. She even told people that she's not going to live past 37. You know, other people saying that she's the happiest woman I've ever met.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why she should have killed herself. Weird stuff. Her death just makes it that much more mysterious and fascinating, and why I wanted to talk about her on the odd cast, you know. In life, man, we would have been best friends, you know. I really feel like she was like a, like just from that, it was like that scene from Somewhere in Time. I'm like, I see that portrait on the wall, right? And I'm like, who is this woman? I need to know who this person is. What happened to her? And then I find out all this.
Well, it sounds like she would have been a large personality even today.
Yeah.
You know, famous.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so it just goes to show you that you don't really know who a person is just by seeing them on the street or seeing them up in the air or in a museum or anywhere. You know, you don't really know who people are until you really kind of, you know, just ask them. Get to know people in a different way.
And you need to get out of your comfort zone, which
right.
I'm not good at. I'll be the first to admit that that's not something that I can
easily
do, but it's something that I am trying to improve myself.
Well,
with.
Yeah. I mean, even like that Bob Lansbury, you know, who people would think he was just a crazy guy, you know, on the streets in some ways, you know, I guess you could say that he was, but you know, that compelled one of our guests that we had on our show when we talked about the history of museums. To actually befriend the man and really find out who this guy even was.
And thank God he did because, you know, Bob has since passed. He learned a lot about Mr. Lansbury, and now we know a little bit more.
Yeah, and, you know, by finding that stuff out, you find more stuff out about yourself, you know, through the process of discovering who this man is. And
how you treat people.
The double X cough drop man is no different. Somebody who you just recognized for 40 years of being this peg-laid guy on the street, you'd be like, I had no idea you were
that guy's
insane stuff. It really does pay to kind of like ask questions. You know, don't be afraid to go up and talk to people and share your stories. And otherwise you'll be forgotten. I mean, these people were kind of forgotten. Helen Ritchie, thank God, is kind of having a little bit of a comeback in McKeesport, at least. She's becoming kind of a like a heroine, you know. But she needs to be that story really needs to be told on a national level. More than anything else, and that.
You have names like Earhart and Lindbergh, and the Wright brothers, and those are three very important names. But there's also a lot of people that we don't talk about, and it's like Helen. There is another name that did these things that are still like today insane to even try the way that she would just cut the engine and then crank it back up again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, crazy.
I would never do that.
No, I would never do that either. And, you know, the fight for equality, you know, in her story is fascinating. Someone should tell her story in a different way, you know.
That's what we just did.
Well, there you go. Continue to tell her story. Tell your friends. Find out. Look at all the photos. You know, those photos, you just type in Helen Ritchie San Diego, by the way, on Google. You're going to come across that San Diego Public Library where there's something like 50, 60 photos of her when she was younger and all throughout her aviation career. But she was one heck of a woman and one heck of a forgotten Pittsburgher, one that I did not know who she was. One of these people like a Jacob Gusky, you know, one of these people like a John Brashear, you know, these little forgotten figures, you know, who kind of all fit back together.
Jacob Gusky, the Jewish Santa Claus.
The Jewish Santa Claus, that's right, you know, and all these little people. I mean, it's important to talk about these people, you know, look at what they've accomplished, look at what they did with their lives. And how you stack up to that, you know? And,
well, exactly. I mean, it's like, you know, Latrobe's own Mr. Rogers.
Right.
Everybody is special.
Right.
And that's very true because we don't necessarily pay attention to everybody, but everybody has a story, and these are some of the ones that come through the cracks.
Literally everybody has a story, you know, and that's the one thing you always got to remember, you know, always search for, like we always say, you know, that you die, the two deaths, you know, one is your natural death, the second is the last time someone speaks your name, and that's what we do here, is we speak these people's names. Let's think about Helen Ritchie for a couple minutes. You know, Helen Ritchie is going to get more thought of than any time since 1937 or 1947 when she passed away. People will be thinking about her now more so than any other time in history before this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of sad, you know, but
But it's also awesome.
It is also awesome. It's the perfect opportunity. So,
and if you have any of those people that you think it was, if it was your grandmother,
right,
your aunt, your uncle, your cousin, let us know. Send John a message, oddpittsburgh@gmail.com.
That's right. I mean, I get messages all the time. It was one I just got, in fact, while we were recording this, from a woman named Laura, and interested about a story about coal mines, you know, or the mining industry in Pittsburgh, or, you know, natural gas, you know, who knows, whatever it is, message me, get a hold of us. We will look at every single thing, you know, every single question. We will get back to answering questions, because I do have a lot. It's my New Year's resolution.
We're going to do that.
Go back and I literally have 50 unread messages, 50. I got 5 today, you know. And a lot of these things are kind of like, my uncle used to own a candy shop in 1928 in Verona. You know,
it's amazing. I'd love to learn about that.
Well, I would like to learn about that, but like, a lot of questions are kind of like that, or, hey, I remember horns. Do you? You know, of course I do. And, but we could talk about those types of things, you know, Pittsburgh department stores, whatever it is. And, without further ado,
that's it. Fort Pitt.